Okay, so we left off last time. We were working our way through the sugya of Yehori Ve'al-Yabor. So just to remind us briefly, without rereading what we had said, there were actually two opinions in the Gemara as to when we say a person has to martyr him or herself rather than violate a particular sin. The three averos under discussion are murder, shvichas damim, gilei raiyos, incest, adultery, and idol worship, idolatry, avodah zarah. Now, everybody agrees on the first two. It's the last one that's the one that's actually subject to dispute. The Rabbi Yochanan's opinion, quoting some Tana, was that avodah zarah, regardless of where you are, one has to give up. You have to give up your life rather than violate. It doesn't matter if it's private. Rabbi Yishmael, however, was of the opinion that there's a distinction between public and private. For Rabbi Yishmael, the issue is very, very clearly just one of Kiddush Hashem and Chilul Hashem. In other words, in private, it's not a Chilul Hashem, and therefore, better to do so than to be killed. In public, it's a Chilul Hashem, and there are things that we believe are worth sacrificing our lives for. Now, the interesting, and as I mentioned last time, part of, I think, what drives Rabbi Yishmael's Shita is the idea that it's very hard to believe. Fundamentally speaking, it's almost impossible to have someone worship Avodah Zarah under duress. And what I mean by that is that worshiping Avodah Zarah requires intent. And if a person bows down, you know, in front of an idol to pick up his change that fell on the ground or his keys that fell on the ground, that's not bowing to an Avodah Zarah. It might be physically the exact same motion. What makes one an act, at worst, the Marisayan, and the other an act of idolatry is the intent behind it. So the notion of someone forcing you to worship Avodah Zarah is in itself a funny idea. What does it mean? Put a gun to man, okay, bow. Or say, this is my God. It's like I can parrot the words, but everybody can presume I don't actually mean it. I think it's a useless idol. So Rabbi Yishmael's opinion is actually, in that respect, I think naturally flows out of that, which is that basically there's nothing usher when they worship Avodah Zarah if you don't actually believe in the Avodah Zarah. If you're going through the motions, the problem is you give the appearance as a worshiper of the Zarah, that's a big Chil Hashem, and that's why he distinguishes between public and private. But that leads to a sort of a second question, which I did not articulate last week, which is what exactly is the position of Rabbi Eliezer, that who believes that Avodah Zarah is Yehoring Ve'al Yavor, even when it's done privately, like the other two averos, like murder, like gilei raiyos. So that's the interesting question. Is the violation now avodah zarah? Is that the violation? Or is it in fact something else? Is it still an issue of Kiddush Hashem and Chilul Hashem? In the following sense, we assume that every avera, to some extent, that is performed is a desecration of God's name. There are bigger averas, there are lesser averas. They're, you know, done in one context, it might be worse than the other. The more people are there, the more Jews are there, the more people, even generally, is the bigger Chilul Hashem it is. So the question is, even for the Chachamim, even for Rabbi Eliezer, who believes that Avodah Zarah isn't distinguished, what exactly is the nature of the violation when something is done under duress? Obviously, one is not allowed to do it. One is obligated to give up one's life. But what is the nature of the violation? I'm not speaking about that in a vacuum, but rather because the Rambam is going to have a very important discussion about this, and it's going to be material to our Gemara and Avodah Zarah as well when we eventually get back there. But those were the two positions that were articulated. And then, when we got to the second paragraph on page one of the handout, we read the first part in which there was a distinction drawn between Shas Hashmad, a time of persecution, of religious persecution, and Shalom B'Shas Hashmad. And the Gemara said that, the Rabbi Yochanan said that B'Shas Hashmad, in a time of religious persecution, one is obligated to martyr oneself, even when it's done for any Aveira. And it would appear it doesn't make a difference whether that Avera is being done in public or in private. So now, let's start again from where we, just a little before we had finished reading last week, at the end of the first line in the second paragraph, the last word. Ki asa ravin amar Rabbi Yochanan. Afilu, and the translation is below. Afilu shalo b'shas hashmad. Lo amru ela betzina alba befarhesya afilu mitzvah kala yehareg v'al yavor. So Ravin quoted Rabbi Yochanan as saying that even when it's not a time of religious persecution, the only time we say that the obligation to martyr oneself is limited to the three sins, that's only in private. But in public, a person has to give up their life, even on a mitzvah kala. My mitzvah kala, asks the Gemara. Amar Rab Yitzchak bar Marav, afilu l'shanuye arkasa demisana, even to change a shoelace. The Rambam says that's an issue of a prohibition, a scriptural prohibition, a deraisa prohibition of chukos hagoyim, imitation of the Gentiles, and other Rishonim say it's a function of a Jewish practice. It doesn't even actually violate any of the mitzvahs of the Torah. It's not a strict halachic isser, but this was minhag of this was a minhag. It wasn't the minhag of Jews, and therefore to do so, and therefore doing so in a time in public or in a time of persecution constitutes a violation of a chil Hashem, presumably, and therefore requires one to martyr oneself. The Kama Parhestia asks the Gemara near the end of the third line, what is considered in public? Amar Rabbi Yaakov, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Ein Parhestia Pchusa Me'asara B'nei Adam. The definition of public means no fewer than 10 people. And then the Gemara adds the following, Pshita, Yisraelim Be'inan, obviously it has to be Jewish, Tichsiv, V'nikdashti B'soch B'nei Yisrael. The definition, the primary definition of Kiddush Hashem and Chilul Hashem is being amongst other Jews. It's a very interesting point that the Gemara makes, and I'm not sure how to understand this more broadly. We often tell our children, I'm sure in Ramaz they tell the kids when they, I hope they do, that when they go on a field trip, you know, that they need to behave themselves extra specially well because they're wearing kippot. And if people see that, you know, and if they misbehave, then it's on top of being wrong, it's also a tremendous chilul Hashem. Now, the interesting question is, who is that really being aimed at? I typically thought it's typically aimed at non-Jews, right? Not at non-from Jews. But based upon this Gemara alone, it would look like that, in fact, the primary definition of chilul Hashem and kiddush Hashem is dependent upon the presence of Jews. Now, it is possible to argue, and that's not usually the way we think. We usually think, you know, you want to keep things in the family, right? It's better, you know, that the family knows, okay, we all understand that, you know, it's our crazy uncle, or the metaphorical equivalent of crazy uncle when someone Jewish does something wrong. But in front of the goyim, that's a shanda. That's the way we usually think. And it could be that that is still true. In other words, the chil Hashem may fundamentally be greater in many contexts with non-Jews, but in this particular specific example, it may be that the violation of Averos under duress, which the outsider looks at and says, hey, you know, it wasn't his fault because after all, someone forced him to do it. But for those who understand the obligation to martyr oneself, so that's where the greater Chilul Hashem is. It's conceivable, I don't know, but it's conceivable that the notion that the Chilul Hashem is greater in the presence of Jews and non-Jews may be limited to this specific kind of context. Clearly, there are plenty of sources in Chazal and in Tanakh as well that speak of Chilul Hashem in the context of non-Jews. But it's not entirely clear how one balances the two. But in this context, the Gemara says the 10, you need 10 Jews. So now the question, there are two questions one might ask, of course. Number one, how do you know that you need, how does this pasuk teach you that you need 10 people? So the Gemara is going to deal with that in a moment. That's the primary question. How do you know it means you need 10 people? The second question, which is really more just a statement, which is somewhat interesting, and not to open up any contemporary issues, but this might be the only place where the din of minyan is d'oraisa. In other words, we require a minyan for tefillah, we require a minyan for baruchu, we require a minyan for kaddish. But those are not scriptural obligations. So the requirement of a minyan there, and again, it's based upon, we say, a davar shebekedusha, sanctifying God's name, you're supposed to have 10 people there. But that's that probably is a din to Rabbanon. The only place where minyan is clearly a din to Raisa, clearly a scriptural requirement, is in fact by Kiddush Hashem, which is interesting in light of contemporary issues, because it's probably the one instance that I'm aware of where women count towards a minyan. I think the general assumption is that when you talk about Asara Yisrael, it doesn't matter whether it's 10 women, 10 men, half women, half men, it doesn't make a difference. So interestingly enough, by the din, which is the Oraisa by minyan, so there actually women count towards the minyan. By the dinim, the Rabbanon of Tefillah and Kedusha, probably, the reasons may be obvious, but in that case they were Mesakein, that in fact it had to be Asara Gedolim B'nei Chorin. One question the Gemara I think does not discuss here, is the question of what about Ketanim? is what would the din be of a katan when it comes to Asar Yisrael? My guess would have been is that it would really depend strictly upon whether the katan understands what's going on. And we certainly have categories in halacha where you have a katan whose intelligence or his understanding of what's going on actually does change the status. And probably you have dinim del raisa that actually can even change based upon the age of the child or the mental capacity of the child. So I presume the same thing is true here as well. While there is sort of, people sometimes have been asked the question, you know, what happens if you have nine men and then you have a boy who's below the age of bar mitzvah, you know, or can you have him hold a sefer Torah? The Pesach of the Shulchan Aruch and the Achrona for the most part is no. There were places that where this was like done, the Rama mentions it, but the practice should be no. The answer is for minyan, for tefillah and so on, katan doesn't count, even if he's holding all the sefer Torah and the Aron. I wouldn't recommend doing that anyway for other reasons, giving certainly more than one. But bottom line is a katan doesn't count. But I suspect that in this case as well, that here a katan who understands might also be constitute one of the minyan. I'm not sure. I don't think that there's any restriction in that respect of a katan. So now the Gemara asks a question. Boy, Rabbi Yirmiya, Tisha Yisrael, v'nachri echad mahu. Let's say in this 10 people, there were 9 Jews and 1 non-Jew. Now, that's kind of a strange question. What's prompting the question? Because the source that the Gemara has quoted so far is just v'nikdashti b'soch b'nei Yisrael. So even if you have a mixed group, if it's mostly Jews at least, you could argue that's called b'soch b'nei Yisrael. That's in the midst of the Jewish people. So the question is this the requirement of 10? In effect, is it 10 and Jews, or is it 10 Jews? And so the Gemara says as follows: Tashma, the Tani Rav Yanai, Achua the Rav Chiya bar Abba, Rav Yanai, the brother of Rav Chiya bar Abba, taught the following brisa: Asya toch, from the word minikdashti besoch bnei Yisrael, we make a gzereshava of toch. Sivhacha minikdashti besoch bnei Yisrael, uksivhasam he badalu mitoch haidah hazos. Ma lahalan asara v'kulu Yisrael, afkan asara v'kulu Yisrael. Yeah, so the truth is, what's kind of interesting here, I didn't actually think about this before, is that I wonder if there's a mistake in citation in the Gemara, but here, I'll tell you what it is actually. There's a missing pasuk. There's a second step from this. I think the Gemara Megillah has. Ibadlu mitoch haidazos. That's from Korach. There you have the word toch. But then they learn eda from the Raglam. Right? The Gemara doesn't quote the whole statement here. And based upon that, just like there are 10 v'kulu Yisrael, afkan asara v'kulu Yisrael, because it was 10, the eda that was described by the Meraglim with the 10 wicked spies, not Yoshua and Kalev, and therefore 10 people are required. One might amusingly note that if this were to be taken at face value and very literally, as a din d'oraisa, you might argue that you need 10 Rishayim for a minion. But nonetheless, that's not what we assume. Interestingly enough, the Gemara has a comment in Krasus that the Ketores had 11 spices. And one of them was chelbana. I forget why chelbana was used or if it's a purpose, but it was rechara. It actually had a bad smell. And the lesson that from that the Gemara derives from that in Maseches Krasus is that when you have a tzibur, the tefillas at tzibur, you have to be mitzarif the poshim. You have to include even the sinners with the tzibur. One of the Achramim, of course, comments, you think this is a wisecrack, but probably not. But yes, but he's only the 11th spice. Anyway, but the bottom line is that we don't assume that in order to have a minyan, they have to be 10 wicked people. It's assumed that in this case, it's Asara Yisrael. Any Asara? In the case of Dvarim Shebekdusha, which are Midr Rabbanan, typically, so there the requirement is Asara, Zacharim, Gedolim, Bnei Chorin. Okay. Anyway, that being the case, and now the Gemara continues. And here's the money question. V'ho Esther Parhes Yahava. You just finished stating that when a Jew is not allowed to ever violate an Avera in public, even to save his or her life, and certainly for less than that. So the question is, how did Esther, she didn't sleep with Ahasuerus publicly, but since she was a concubine, her going to the king, everybody understood what the terms of engagement were. So how could Esther do that? Now, who was Esther? This is a very crucial question. I know we know who Esther is. What was Esther's status? So, in the Megillah itself, the pshat is Esther was Mordechai's cousin. She was a single woman, you know, and she was one of the people, as they gathered in all the women, all the single women from the kingdom, at least according to pshat, single women. The Medrash says differently. So she was a single woman. So what exactly is the prohibition of a single Jewish woman sleeping with a non-Jewish man? So it's not entirely clear. If it's not done in the manner of marriage, so that might be the problem with Esther, if it's not done in the manner of marriage, it's not entirely clear. A Jewish man with a non-Jewish woman, so that already has a much more serious status, I don't say ironically, because there, at least in the tradition of Pinchas, Kanayim Pogimbo. It's not clear still what the prohibition is when it's not done in the manner of marriage, but nonetheless, the Mishnah in Sanhedrin says that a person who does that publicly, whatever publicly means exactly, so the zealots can run him through with their sword. Mm-hmm. And that was what Pinchas did. But that's only true by a Jewish man and non-Jewish woman. It's not true in the reverse. So it's not. So if without marriage, it's not clear what the prohibition is. With marriage, it would appear to be a violation of losis chatein bam. Losis chatein bam, which is a pasuk at the end of Parshas Vayeshanan, which means you're not supposed to marry. In that case, it was talking about the seven nations, but maybe it applies to all the nations, all non-Jews, so you're not allowed to marry them. Now, is that prohibition included in Gilui Arayos in as one of the three sins you have to give your life for? So the answer is no. As I mentioned last time, Gilui Arayos is limited to those things in the Parshios of Achrei Mos Kedoshim. Generally speaking, it's adultery, incest, and probably male homosexuality. It does not include bestiality in that regard, in terms of, even though there's a death penalty for it when done with willingly, that's the Gilui Arayos is a narrow set. Not every prohibited sexual relationship or act is included in Gilui Arayos. So I mentioned that a Kohen marries a Grusha. It's not Gilui Arayos. It's a Losase. He has to divorce her, but the marriage is binding. But Gilui Arayos does not include everything, and it does not include a Jew and a non-Jew. That's not usually assumed can assume Gilui Arayos. So Esther's Avera, at worst, would have been Lo Sischatein Bam, right? It would not have been Gilui Arayos, but it was very public, right? It wasn't a secret that Esther was the queen. And you might have argued that in the context of the harem, maybe it wouldn't have been so public. Nobody would have known it was realized Esther was there, but she was the queen. So the Gemara wants to know if Rabbi Yochanan is correct, if the statement of Ravin in the name of Rabbi Yochanan is correct, that in public one always has to give up one's life, so then how could Esther have done what she did? Now,
have you changed the definition of Farhesia? Because before Farhesia seemed like it was before witnessed by 10 people. Now it just seems that if people hear about it.
So I think the assumption is that it's not, in other words, it's not just, not I heard a rumor, it got out later. Everybody knows. In other words, this is very, very public. The sexual act is not public with Achashverosh and Esther.
It was a proclamation. But,
what's that?
It was a proclamation.
Right, everybody understands.
But it sounded like the act was being witnessed.
I'm not arguing with that. It's true, but you see from the second Gemara that Parhesia has a slightly broader definition. It doesn't have to be, you know, you're seeing the actual act with your two eyes. Now,
it's very easy to get the Eda, because if it's just...
Well, but it has to. People have to know that it's happening, right? And you don't necessarily know, because a Jewish man and a non-Jewish woman, or vice versa, have yichud, you don't know what's going on. But when Achashverosh marries Esther, everybody understands. You don't have to know the very moment that's going on, but everybody understands that. Now, here's the interesting question. There is a medrash in the Gemara quotes in Maseches Megillah, that when it says that when Esther's parents died, so lekacha Mordechai, and lo levas, she was like a daughter. But the reading that the Gemara has is al tikri levas ela levayis, that Mordechai actually married his cousin. He married Esther. Now, there are other midrashim that talk about that make it clear that work with this same idea. So now the question gets interesting. If that's the case, why is the Gemara asking about Esther being Befarhesia? It doesn't matter whether it's public or private. It's Gilui Arayos. She's a married woman. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're just learning this Gemara, you're not going to ask that question, right? But the Rishonim, well aware of the Gemara Megillah, are bothered. Why does the Gemara not invoke that? We're going to come out and talk about that. That is a central piece in the discussion of the Rishonim on this sugya, which is why does the Gemara ask the question about Esther only from the fact that it was Farhesia, you know, which is a claim of Rabbi Yochanan, it's a statement of Rabbi Yochanan. If all of the Tanoim, everybody holds that Gilui Arayos is in fact and demands martyrdom, how could Esther have done what she did? Forget whether it was public or not.
It was the Shas Hadchak.
When someone puts a gun to your head and says, you know, do X, worship Avodah Zarah, that's also a Shas Hadchak.
But in this case,
The whole Am was going to be...
But what would have happened? What would have happened if Esther refused? They would have killed her. Okay, fine.
That's exactly what it is.
No,
that's exactly what it is.
But she advocated to allow for the saving of the Jews.
Oh, I mean, wait a second.
That's the whole... Isn't that why she was... You know...
Hold on. Here's the catch. So I'm going to, you know... Let's ask your question again later. But when she was taken as the concubine and then queen, nobody knew then. There was no Xeria. That's in Perek Beis. Right? It's only the next chapter that Mordechai gets us in trouble, right? But in that chapter, for refusing, according to tradition, refusing to bow to Haman, but according to tradition, because Haman made himself into an Avodah Zarah. Okay.
Right.
But just hold off on your question. We can discuss that later because there's one piece at the end of Tosus which sort of raises a broader question. But when Esther did it, she didn't know that was coming. Okay, so that's the question. How could the Gemara miss the obvious question? Right? So, we're going to come back to that. But, for the moment, the Gemara asked the question, how could Esther do what she did? And the Gemara quotes Abaye as follows. Amar Abaye, Esther karka olam paisa. Esther was passive. Now, what does this mean? So, the assumption is that normally, it's not impossible. A man, by definition... Essentially, by definition, the sexual act is considered active. A woman can be considered passive. And therefore, what the Gemara is claiming here, it seems, is that in the context, at least, of a public aveira, the question is whether this can be applied more broadly, if the party is passive in the particular act, then there's no obligation to martyr yourself. In other words, it's only if they want you to do something. If they want you to allow something to be done to you, so then that's okay. So Tosfos quotes an example, which may or may not be a good example. Tosfos, eventually get them in his discussion, says if they want to use you, if they ask you to kill someone, that's usser. But if they want to throw you off the roof onto a tinok, where you're going to kill the tinok, but you may survive, so that you're not obligated to fight them off, because you're not actually doing anything, and you're a passive instrument in their hands. That's what Tosfos will claim. So that is Abaye's answer, that Esther was karka olam haisa. Rava gives a different answer. Rava Amar, Hanos Atzman Shani. Rava says that no, that when we say that a person has to give up his life in public, when it's an Aveira, for any Aveira, that means when the guy is doing it in order to have you violate your religion. In other words, Shas Hashmad, when it's a time of broad persecution of the Jewish people, it doesn't matter where the sin is taking place, you have to give up your life, public or private. But let's say it's not a Shas Hashmad, but this guy... He doesn't like Jews, and he's powerful. And he finds you, and he tells you, I want you to fix my car on Shabbos. I don't need my car fixed. I want you to change the tires. He's got perfectly good tires on the car, and he's going to put on the same tires, but I want to make you be Mechal on Shabbos. So if that's done in public, L'ha'viro al-daz, so then you're obligated to give up your life. But if, in fact, the guy's car broke down, and you know how to fix it, you're a mechanic, and you know how to fix it, and he says, fix my car, and he says, I'm sorry, it's my Shabbos, he says, I don't care, fix my car. So then, he doesn't care whether you're Mechal Shabbos or not, he doesn't care if you conjure up, you know, the genie, and the genie fixes it on Shabbos, and you're not Mechal Shabbos. He wants his car fixed, because he wants to drive somewhere. So that's what Rava says, Hanas Atzman Shani. And Rava's point, I think, is that it's only a Chilul Hashem if it's them versus us, and they're winning. You see, they have power of us, and they make us violate our own religion. But if you're talking about a situation where anybody understands the guy, he just needs his car fixed. He's not interested in your Chilul Shabbos. He would do the same thing on Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday, and Wednesday. So then you're allowed to do so to save your life. And the fact that it's not being done for the purpose of violating the Torah, therefore it's not a Chilul Hashem, or certainly not of the same magnitude to demand martyrdom. Okay, so that's what Rava says. And then Tosfos quotes, Rava quotes, various kind of examples where we are forced to do certain kinds of things, and it's only done l'hanas atzman. Okay. And the Gemara then says the following, if you skip to the second to last line, the Azda Rava L'tamei, at the end, or at the end of the second to last full line, the Amar Rava, Nochri da Amri Le Lahai Yisrael, Kitol Asafsita B'Shabata V'Shada L'Chiyusa. If a guy says to a Jew, kill, you know, cut this alfalfa on Shabbos and throw it, give it to the animals to feed it to them. V'ilo katil nulach, and if not, I'm going to kill you. Liktol v'lo liktalei. You should. Liktal means he should let him. He should cut it and not have the guy kill him. Shadi lanahara, cut the alfalfa and throw it into the river. in which case he's doing it just to make you be Michal Shabbos. Likatle velo likto. Better that let the guy kill him and not hit, and he not cut the asafsata, my taima, la avure milsa kabai, because in the latter case it's clear the guy's doing it only for the purposes of making the Jew violate the Shabbos. Okay. So what the Gemara then leaves us is the following. It says there are three averos, so a person always has to give up one's life, although avodah zarah, it's a machlokas whether that's only public or even in private. The other two are gilei arayos and shvichos damim. The second thing that emerges from the Gemara is that in the time of persecution, in the Shas HaShemad, you have to give up your life for any avera. And the third thing that emerges is that if something is being done in public, then according to Abaye, if you are active, you have to give up your life. If you're passive, you don't. According to Rava, you only have to give up your life if the goy's intent is, in fact, to make you violate the halacha. If he's doing it for his own benefit, then you're not obligated to sacrifice yourself. So now the only interesting question is, what is the relationship of Rava to Abaye's answer? In other words, would Rava agree with Abaye and say, yes, if you're passive, then you don't have to give up your life? But in addition, even if you're active, you don't have to give up your life unless it's being done la avira al das, to cause him, it's done in, for spite to make him violate the halacha, not because the guy actually needs something. Or would Rava say, no, I don't care about active and passive, it makes no difference. All that matters is what the intent of the non-Jew was. So that's really a central question. We're going to come back to it when we get to Tosas. But first I wanted to read the Rambam, because the Rambam's presentation is rather interesting. And I've sort of, I telegraphed the Rambam a little bit what's coming with the focus on Chilul Hashem.
Well, so if you reversed it, it wouldn't be a problem, right? You know, the question reversed from Rava to Abaye, what would happen?
You could ask the question in the reverse, but we're certainly going to paskin like Rava, as a general rule. Whenever it's a machlokes on Abaye, so it doesn't, you're correct, it's a valid question as well.
But
it doesn't matter the halacha, because we're going to paskin like Rava. So the only question is, does Rava also accept Abaye's answer? I mean, it's two possible distinctions, or only one? So the Rambam, and I've actually thought that this is quite a powerful statement. It's very clear, from the Rambam, if it's not already clear from the Sugya, that the most, if you can talk about the central value in Torah, which is always dangerous, it's always dangerous because if you sometimes overemphasize one value, you've effectively made an avodah zarah. But if you wanted to talk perhaps about the most central value in Torah, I think it's pretty clear that that is Kiddush and Chilul Hashem. That might be whether a Jew sanctifies or Chas v'Shalom desecrates God's name, that is probably the most central principle of Torah. And I think that's, if it's not already clear from the Gemara's discussion, it's clear from the Rambam. The Rambam writes as follows, and this is the first halacha that the Rambam chooses to talk about, halacha l'maisa. The first four chapters of the Mishnah Torah, Hilchos Yesodei Torah, is about the mitzvah of knowing God, loving God. It's really basically the Rambam's philosophy and metaphysics, right? All his Aristotelian stuff, right? The first sort of, you know, for those who want to learn the Mishnah Torah, many people might skip the first four parakim of the Rambam because you can't understand half of it anyway. And the first place you really start is with the fifth parak. And the first thing the Rambam chooses to talk about is Yehari V'al Yav, or the issue of martyrdom, because it's all about Kiddush Hashem. And the Rambam writes as follows, Kol Beis Yisrael, Mitzuvim, the translation, courtesy of Chabad, is on the, starts on the next sheet. Kol Beis Yisrael, Mitzuvim al Kiddush Hashem HaGadol Hazeh, Shenemar, V'nikdashti B'soch B'nei Yisrael. So the Kiddush Hashem HaGadol, the Shem HaGadol the Rambam was just talking about in the first four chapters, we are all commanded for on sanctifying God's name, Shenemar, Minikdashti B'soch B'nei Yisrael. It's interesting, the Rambam's formulation, Kol Beis Yisrael, even though some know in yesterday's reading, Kosomar Leves Yaakov V'sagei Levnei Yisrael, Beis Yaakov in that case is said to be the women, and Bnei Yisrael said to be the men, but in this case, it's pretty clear, Kol Beis Yisrael makes no distinction, I mean, it's not Beis Yisrael, it's Beis Yaakov and Bnei Yisrael, but in this case, Kol Beis Yisrael means all the Jewish people, men, women, maybe even children, are commanded on Kiddush Hashem. Musharin, we are also warned, shelo l'chalalo, not to desecrate God's name. Shenemar velo sechalalu Hashem kachi. Ketzad, kishiyamod oved kochavim, if a non-Jew arises, v'yenoses Yisrael la'avor al achas mikol mitzvos hamuras betora, o yahargenu, and he threatens to kill the Jew, and he makes him, forces him, to worship, to violate one of the mitzvahs of the Torah, or he will kill the Jew. Ya'avor v'al yeharek. The Jew should violate the Avera, and not only say not only should, as I said a moment, absolutely categorically must. V'al yeharek, and should not let himself be killed. Shenemar b'mitzvahs asher yaseh osam ha'adam v'chai bohem. The two mitzvahs are the purpose of giving life, and in a case where a mitzvah, doing a mitzvah, is going to cause death, v'chai bahem v'lo sheyamos bahem. It's that you should live by them and not die by them. V'imeis v'lo avar. If a person chose to martyr him or herself anyway and not violate the avera, harezeh mischayev b'nafsho, which is a funny kind of expression because you're dead already.
Okay?
But nonetheless, it means you have violated a sin that's worthy of chiyuv misa.
Do you think this is not necessarily, he's trying to make a point here about the power of it? It makes no,
Well, I understand. So, unless it means in terms of olam haba. That's the other possibility, in terms of the world to come. But the Rama makes clear that yeharek v'al yavor is not optional. I mean, there are no optional situations, as we're going to see. It's either mandatory or prohibited. Early in the Masechta, many, 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 many months ago, or in the category of years, I think towards the end of the first parak, Tosos has a discussion in the Sugya. Those who are doing Daf Yomi are probably just about to do it or just did it, the story of Chanina ben Tradion. So we learned this a long time ago. Chanina ben Tradion was one of the famous martyrs. So the question is one allowed to volunteer martyrdom? So the Balei HaTosos, in situations where you're not technically obligated, and the Balei HaTosos seem to take a lenient position on this issue. Given the history of martyrdom in Ashkenaz, this is perhaps not surprising. We're going to see an amazing, amazing comment of Tosos, not today, in Avodah
no.
Zarah. What?
Lenient meaning no. That you don't.
No, that you can.
You can. Yes.
Yes.
I know that we don't consider letting yourself be killed. He's such a makel,
right.
He's so lenient because he gave up his life.
So I wanted to clarify
But it's a kula on shvichas damim, on your own spilling of your own blood. That's bodily what it means. So there's another amazing line we're going to see in Tosfos on our Gemara, which again is so much a Tosfos refuses to read our sugya in perhaps its most simple form because it was impossible. With Chas v'Shalom, that could be the case. We'll see that, but I don't doubt that the history of Ashkenaz and of martyrdom in Ashkenaz plays a role in the way the Shittos of Rishonim, particularly because the Derech of Balei HaTosos, their method, was to defend communal practice, and since Jews were doing it, it had to be defended. Okay, so now the Rambam continues. Bamed v'amamur, when is this true that you have to martyr, that you're not allowed to martyr yourself and you must preserve your life? Bishar mitzvos, chutz me'avodas kochavim v'gilei arayas ha'shrichos damim. Everything except for the big three. Avol, shalosh averos, elu. These three averos, im yomar lo avor alachas mehen ote horeg, ye horeg v'al yavor. Then you have to martyr yourself. You should be killed. Let him be killed and not violated. Now, that's where the Rambam. So that's the distinction the Rambam draws between all mitzvahs of the Torah, with the exception of the three, and then the three. Bamed dvar mamurim. When is this true that you're not obligated to give up your life for other mitzvahs? Bisman sha'oved kochavim miskaven lahanas atzma. When the guy is doing it for his own benefit.
That's the car breaking down.
Yes, kigon. That's feeding the asafsata to the animals. Kigon sha'anso livnos beso b'shabbos. The guy forces him to build a house on Shabbos. The kinyan building a house. O lavasha lo tafshilo, or to cook his food. O anas ishla boa lava chayotze b'zeh. Or if the guy, physically forces a woman and rapes her. Avol niskave lahaviro al hamitzvos bilvad. If the only purpose of the guy doing it was to be mavir al hamitzvos, then im hoya beino levein atzmo ve'ein shama asar mi Yisrael ya'avor v'al yehareg. Then if it's in private, there aren't 10 other Jews there or 10 Jews there. So then you violate it and you don't martyr yourself. Im anso lahaviro ba'asar mi Yisrael. If there are 10 Jews present, yehareg v'al yavor. That's obvious because the Gimel Averis, it doesn't matter what the circumstances are. Now, I want to ask you a question. What does the Rambam hold with respect to Abaye's answer? The Rambam is clearly quoting Rava's distinction between Hano'as Atzmo, his own benefit, versus Laha'aviro Aldas. But what about Abaye's position that Karka Olam? Now, you could simply argue from the fact that the Rambam omits it, that he doesn't buy into the distinction. And that would probably be correct as well. But there's even something in the halacha that the Rambam may have gone out of his way to make clear that we reject Abaye's Teretz. And what is that? One of the examples that the Rambam quoted. He said, if the guy forced a woman, you know, to rape her, so the assumption now, what, are we talking about Gilei Arayos or not Gilei Arayos? I presume we're not talking about Gilei Arayos because, as the Rambam makes clear at the end, he's talking about even other mitzvos. I presume his example is being drawn from a guy wants to sleep with a single Jewish woman. So therefore, and the Rambam says, if it's done lahanas atzmo is mutter, if it's done lahavira al das, it would be usur if it's in public. So it really sounds, and we can think, who is that, of course?
Esther.
So it sounds like the Rambam has gone out of his way to reject the notion of karka olam being relevant in this context. Now that's actually very important. That's very important because it means that the Rambam doesn't believe that in general, in the sugya of Yehori v'al Yavor, there's any distinction between active and passive. Now, the Rambam continues. Halacha Gimel. V'chol ha-devarim ha-elu, shelo b'shas ha-gzeira. This is only when there's no decree of persecution against the Jewish religion. Avol b'shas ha-gzeira, v'hu she-yamon melech Russia, ki Nebuchadnezzar v'chave-rav. And Nebuchadnezzar, he might have been a Russia for many reasons, but what the Rambam is thinking about here is particularly the story when he wanted to make everybody bow down to the idol. He made this andarta, and he wanted everybody to bow down. And of course, there were three Jews who didn't bow down to the idol. Those three Jews' names were Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And what I call the original story of the Kibshon Ha'esh is actually found in the book of Daniel, the story of the fiery furnace, because Nebuchadnezzar tosses the three of them in there, and God saves them. Okay, so V'hu sheyamod Rasha k'Nebuchadnezzar v'chaveirav v'yigzar gezerah al Yisrael levatel dosam O mitzvah min ha-mitzvos. So either to persecute their religion as a whole or some of the individual mitzvahs. Then, yehareg v'al yavar. One should martyr oneself and not violate it. Afilu al-achas mishar mitzvos. It doesn't matter if it's one of the other mitzvos. Beinenas besoch hasara, beinenas beino lovein ovdei kochavim. It doesn't matter whether it's public or private. Shas hashmad, private is public. And therefore, one is obligated to give up one's life. Presumably, Shas Hashmat also means, although you could argue there might be a distinction, also means that the intent of the non-Jew is to lahavira al das. We raised this question last week. Let's say it's a Shas Hashmat, but this guy, he's not interested in the Shmat. He just wants his car fixed. He really couldn't care less. So it's possible that you could say that that's not called Shas Hashmat. Shas Hashmat is only doing something when it's done in the context of persecution, not, you know, of religious persecution, not in the context of that just happens to be during the same time period. Okay, now, here's the really interesting part in the Rambam. Komi shenemar bo, it's all very interesting, but this is particularly striking. Komi shenemar bo yavor v'yahari, halacha dalet. Anyone about whom it is said that he should violate the avera and not be killed, v'nehara, but chose to martyr him or herself instead, v'lo avar, and not violate the avera, the mitzvah, harezim ischai b'nasho. He said that already. V'komi shenemar bo yehari v'yavor, v'nehara, v'lo avar, anyone who is told to martyr him or herself and does so. I lost my place again. Harezeh kideshes Hashem. He's mekadesh shem shemayim. Him hoya basar mi Yisrael. Harezeh kideshes Hashem mirabim. Then he's made a big kiddush Hashem. Kidaniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah. Daniel and the lions then. Nebuchadnezzar didn't want anybody praying to another god, and Daniel prayed. Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah refused to bow to the image. And Rabbi Akiva, Vachave Rav, many who died in the pursuit of the study of Torah. So these are people who were Mekadesh Shem Barabim. Now I think Rambam does make clear a very important point here. That what is the purpose of martyrdom when it's in private? Kiddush Hashem, even though it's not in public. The difference between martyrdom in private and martyrdom in public is one is a Kiddush Hashem and one is Kiddush Hashem Berabim, which is even bigger.
Rabbi Akiva did the big three?
No, Rabbi Akiva martyred himself because he continued to study and teach Torah. The Romans decreed that no one should teach Torah.
That's
a Shas Hashmad. And you see, by the way, you might even argue that it proves that even though Rabbi Akiva could have been passive, he could have just not taught Torah. And instead, he went ahead and taught Torah. Sounds like Karka Olam doesn't actually matter. you either have to say karka olam doesn't matter, or that you can volunteer martyrdom. One of the two, it would seem. So the Rambam would probably say, right, karka olam doesn't matter. If your job in life is teaching Torah, if that's your role, then even if you can't, and then there's a persecution, there's a decree made against teaching Torah, you can't argue, I'm not doing anything, so it's okay. Right? You're obligated to teach Torah, even on the pain of death. Okay. So, so you can get Mrs. Asse that you violate, you know, you can get things that are violated become Vase.
Right.
An Isser Asse. You have such things.
It's not clear, he's not making that distinction clearly yet, right?
Well, again, I think it's clear for the Rambam that it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether it's active or passive. It's one more proof. And these are the people who are referred to as the Haruge Malchus that the Gemara praises as heroes, those who were executed by the empire. Again, Shein Maila Amalasan, there's no one above them. Vadleim Nemar, Kialecha Huragnu Kolayom Nechshanu Kitzon Tivcha. We say to the Kadosh Baruch Hu, we have been slaughtered over you, over your name, over loyalty to you all day. We were like a sheep like sheep at the slaughter. Va'aleim Nemar Isulicha Sidai Korsei Brisi Ola Ale Zevach. God says, gather to me my pious ones who are who have consummated the bris Ale Zevach. I suspect what's being meant here, Ale Zevach doesn't mean a sacrifice in the sense of an animal, which is the pshat in the pasuk, but it means having sacrificed themselves. The Homi Shenemar Bo Yehuri V'Al Yavor V'Ovar V'Lo Nerag Hareza Mechalel Es Hashem. If someone violates something for which they should have martyred themselves, they have desecrated God's name. They were Mechalel Shem Shemaim. V'im Hoya Ba'asar Mi Yisrael Hareza Chilel Es Hashem Berabim U'Bito Mitzvah Sasei Shikidish Hashem V'Ovar Mitzvah Slo Sasei Shichil Hashem. He has desecrated God's name in public. He has been Mevatel the Mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem. He has violated the Aver of Chil Hashem. V'Aval Pikein Nonetheless, because it was done under duress, ein malkinoso vein tzarich lomar she'im emisinoso bebeisdin. Afilu harag ba'ones. Beisdin does not punish him. Not malkus and certainly not misa. Why? Because it was an aveira done under ones. And apparently, we didn't read that in our Gemara. The Gemara has the expression, ones rachmana patre. The Torah exempted an ones. So what emerges, She'ein, the Rambam continues, She'ein Malkin Amomisin El Over Bertzono Over Edom Vasra. We don't give Malkus or the death penalty except for to someone who violates it willingly with witnesses and warning. She'nemar Benosein Mizara La Molech, with someone who violates the Avodah Zarah of handing over his child to the Molech, whatever exactly that is. Benosati Ani Espanai Ba'ishahu. I will place my anger against that man, Ba'ishahu, Mipia Shimu Alamdu Hahu, Velo Anus, Velo Shogeg, Velo Muta. There is no punishment to Beis Din by someone who is coerced, someone who does it by mistake, someone who does it in error. Uma im avodas kochavim shichamur mik minakol ovedo saba ones enu chayiv kares. If avodah zara, which is the most severe avera, nonetheless, you're not chayiv anything. If you do a pa'ones, you're not chayiv kares, ve'ein tzarech lomar misa spesin, kavachomer l'shar mitzvos amos betorah. It's a kavachomer for all other mitzvos. Ubarayos hu omer, ve'lanara lo sasa davar. And that's the source the Gemara quotes, lanara lo sasa davar, ones rachmana patre. So the Rambam here is really, really, really interesting. The Rambam argues that if a person violates shvichas, doesn't act of shvichas damim in gilei arayos and avos under duress, they haven't violated gilei arayos, they haven't violated shvichas damim, they haven't violated avodah zarah. What have they done? They were mechal shem shemaim. So it would seem. Now, you could choose another formulation, and you'll see why this is important in terms of our Gemara. You might say that they did violate avodah zarah, gilei arayos, and shvichas damim, but there is no onesh. So this was the hakira that I raised last time, is that when we say onesh rachmana patre, does it mean that there's no punishment, or it's not even an avera of the thing that you did?
He spells it out. I don't think it's so unclear.
Which do you think he's opting for?
Chol Hashem.
So the question is, clearly the Rambam says the avera that he did, for which he is culpable, except for there's no specific punishment, is Chil Hashem and Kiddush Hashem, right? There's no punishment in Beis Din for being Mechal Hashem Shemayim. It's a terrible Aveira, right? We say that only your death can serve as a full kapara for Chil Hashem. But there's no action item on that. right? The only action item that there would have been on would have been on the Avodah Zarah, the Gilad Raya, the Shvichas Damim, that normally carry the death penalty. In this case, the Rambam says you're potter because you did it under onus. And what you did violate, and you violated knowingly, was Chilul Hashem. But the question I want to know is, even though there's no punishment for Gilad Raya and Shvichas Damim and Avodah Zarah, nonetheless, is the act a Mas Avera of Avodah Zarah, Gilad Shvichas Damim? And we'll see why in our Gemara it's important. What?
But wouldn't he have said that? In other words, by omitting it, it seems
so,
like...
So that's an argument he made on the one hand. On the other hand, what is the relevance? Right? Now, you should ask me the question. Okay, very nice. I'm engaged in legal casuistry. Is it a Masa Avera, but there's no punishment, or is it not even a Masa Avera? Right. So last week I gave an example of a Nafgamina in Hilchos Shabbos, that if you burn someone's house down... depending on whether the Chilul Shabbos was a Chilul Shabbos, but it was done b'shogeg, or it was a Chilul Shabbos, but there's no punishment, then you would be exempt from paying for the house, because we apply the principle of Kam Leib Rabbi Minei. You, in effect, were Mechal Shabbos. When you're Mechal Shabbos, you don't pay money for the crime. You get, at least theoretically, the death penalty, and even if you don't get it, you're still Pater. If you argue, however, that it's not even an act of Chilul Shabbos at all in the Torah, for whatever the technical reasons, then you would be liable to pay the money. Now, our Gemara is going to have an afgamina, potentially in a different kind, slightly more practical. I mean, to the extent that this is practical at all, actually something more obvious. So, I agree, the Rambam is not clear. It's hard to tell. Does he omit it because it's just not on the agenda now, because these are obscure nafgaminas, these obscure cases where it really matters, and he's just contrasting it with Chil Hashem, which you really have violated in full force now, or is it because he believes it's not at all an act of Aveir of Shvichas Damim Gilrayas Sabo Dezara, it's only Chil Hashem. Okay. So that's point number one. Point number two is the following. The Rambam continues. He says, "Avalam yocho lemalit nafsho v'levroach mitachas yad hamelach harasha ve'eno osa hinehu kekelev shav al ko." If he could have fled that situation, run away, and he didn't, and then he was forced to do it, he is like a kelev shaval ko. Is this true? I don't know. Ko means it's vomit. That a dog will eat what it spits up.
Yeah.
Okay. I've never had a dog. Spend enough time with dogs, but kelev shav al ko. The end of the pasuk, by the way, Mishlei, is kisil shoneh beivalto, a fool who repeats his foolishness. Or the way Rabbi Dulitz always used to say to us, "Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me." So the Rambam says if he finds himself in a situation, and then he has a chance to flee and doesn't, he's like a kelev shaval keo, v'hu nitra oved avodas kochavim b'mezid. He's really viewed as someone who violated b'mezid, v'hu nitrad min ha'olam haba. He loses his portion in the world to come, v'yorei the madrega tachtona shel gehenim. So really, that's interesting in its own right. In other words, as opposed to just a regular oved avodas zara willingly, this guy is somehow worse, which is kind of interesting. I guess maybe it's a statement about those who can help themselves but refuse to do so. I don't know.
There's no Indian of the base in here.
Because in most cases in martyrdom, there's no Edim and Hasra. That's probably why. Correct, technically, but it's pretty rare that would happen.
I know, that was very much theoretical, academic. Right.
Now, Halacha Vav, which is the last part, which I'll do only because we might as well complete the topic, and it's fascinating in its own right, and food for thought. Ke'inyan sha'amru ba'onsin, kach amru ba'chaloyim. When we normally think of violating mitzvahs of the Torah to save our lives, our normal scenario, our everyday scenario, is not a guy comes up to you, you know, and wants to kill you unless you violate an avera, right? Typically, it's a situation where a person is sick, and they need to violate an avera to save their lives. We think about on Shabbos, we think of a person who's starving, or, you know, whatever it is. Those are the typical cases. Shabbos, machalos, asuros, are the usual culprits. So the Rambam says, "Kishem sha'amru ba'onsin, kach amru b'chaloyim." As they said, with respect to onus, which means an anos is a bully or a violent thug or something like that. Just like they said by onsin, so too by chaloyim, by sicknesses. Ketzad, misha chala v'nata lamus. If someone was sick and was in danger of dying, the doctors say that he needs the following thing in order to save himself, and it's one of the things that's awesome in that Torah. They say, you know, it's a machlokas in the Mishnah whether this works or not, but they thought one the cure in the pre-vaccine era for rabies was to feed the person from the liver of the rabid dog. Now, Adrian, don't ask me. And listen, when you have no other choices, you know, it can't hurt. So, this is a machlokas, whether you're allowed to, because the machlokas in the Gemara, whether it's efficacious or not. But, let's assume that it were. So then we'd be permissible, and there you need machalos asuris to save your life. So, the Rambam says that it would be permissible. Umisrapim b'chol yisurim shebatorah, b'makom sakana, chutz me'avodah zara v'gileh ra'yis v'shvichos damim. Shafilu b'makom sakana, e misrapim mehem. Okay, that's pretty straightforward. Now here's the interesting line. Im avar v'nisrape, onshino so based in onesh hara'ila. If he goes ahead and he violates under the circumstances, based in punishes him onesh hara'ila. Now, the interesting question is how to read onesh hara'ila. The question is, I would say in English, do you read it as the punishment that is fitting for him, or a punishment that is fitting for him? If you, you know, the English translation, again, courtesy of Chabad, I forgot to put that at the end, you should know in general. My Gemara translations are from the Sansino, which is out of copyright, and my Rambam translations are from Chabad, who has publicly posted their materials. Any other translation is probably my own. I'm not complaining about the translation, I'm just like to give credit. The last line is, if one transgresses and uses them as a remedy, the court may impose the appropriate punishment upon him. So that in itself is a certain kind of reading, which is not clear if it's correct. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, I don't remember exactly what he says. I edited this volume and the article, but we didn't do much editing to it. When Rav Aaron Soloveitchik submitted an article, you published the article. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik's on Ravacha in the Sefer, I think it's the Kavod HaRav, it was the memorial volume for the Rav, so he wrote about this Rambam. And the simple mashmos, the simple sense of this Rambam, is that he's actually distinguishing between when you do an Avera under duress of a thug, of a violent person who forces you to do it, versus when you do it to save your life because of an illness. In effect, the former is considered coercion, the latter is considered somewhat voluntary. In other words, an externally imposed onus is called an onus, and if you act upon that to save your life, you did it under duress. But if you are sick, when no one is forcing you to do so, then to do so is actually, in a situation where you are prohibited from doing so, is considered not under coercion, it's considered willing, and therefore you are actually high of the punishment that is due you. So that's a really interesting distinction to think about. I don't want to explore that one now, but I'm more interested in the broader point of the Rambam, which is that the violation of an Avera where you're supposed to martyr yourself is actually a violation of Chilul Hashem. Whether or not, the question is whether it's technically a violation of those Yisurim, it's not entirely clear, but certainly in the case where it's a goy who's an anas, not a sickness, so a person is exempt from any punishment because he did it, the Averi he did it under duress, the Chilul Hashem he did willingly, because the Chilul Hashem he or she was supposed to give up his or her life for.
It's also a weird cure to have one of those three be the cure for your illness. I don't know what illness.
So I'll give you a very, very easy case. This is the contemporary ethical question. Let's say you believe that brain death is not dead, but you have a person basically who is brain dead, who's only on the ventilator and so on, and if you take their organs, you will kill them, but you will save one life or multiple lives.
That's a good example.
Now, you know, the Gemara has, it has to
that
be one...
of not conscious, though.
What's that?
It
doesn't matter if you believe that brain death is not dead and you wrote him.
He can't impose that punishment upon himself. Well, I guess he could
have
written before.
You are committing, the doctor's committing murder in order to save a patient's life. Right. The Gemara has the example by Gilei Arayos. It's a fascinating passage. It's the last Gemara in this. I didn't go to the end of the parak. It's another like Amud, where the Gemara tells the story. There are a lot of odd things about the story, but the Gemara says that there was a Maisa with an Ish who was lovesick. I would say he wasn't lovesick. He was infatuated with this woman, and the doctor said that Tibaylo or Yamos, that she sleep with her or he's going to die. And the Chachamim said Yamos fell Tibaylo. Then they said, okay, Tama lefanav aruma. You stand in front of him unclothed. And the Gemara and the Chachamim said, Yomus v'altam l'fanam amrumah. And finally it said, Tisaper imo me'achorei agedar. She should talk to him from behind the fence. I don't know if it means just to have a conversation, or it meant, you know, it was like one of these 900 numbers, right? The dirty talking or something that would satisfy his desire. And the Chachamim said, Yomus v'altasaper imo me'achorei agedar. So then the Gemara says, the Gemara is a machloka. Some said she was an Ashes Ish, and some said she is the Panuya. So the Gemara says, Hanicha, it makes sense if she was an Ashes Ish. But if a Panuya, why were they? Why didn't they just say what was the big deal? What was the big deal? You know, it's not arayos. So this, by the way, as an aside, is very important for a topic we discussed a long time ago. We did a little bit of Herig V'Ayavar in the second parak, where the Gemara talks about not being misrape ba'atzei asherah. You can't use asherah wood to save your life. And it was a machlokas harishon on what that meant. Tosos said it really meant incantations. It was really avodah zarah. But many rishon, the Ran and others, say no. It means atzei. You're not using avodah zarah. It's just wood that was from an asherah tree. And the prohibition you're violating is not avodah zarah. It's an accessory to avodah zarah. It's what we call abizrayu. And that's why, following that Ran, the Shulchan Aruch Paskins, you have to give up your life not only for the gimel averus, but even for ancillary prohibitions, even for the accessories. So this gemara actually sounds very much like that. In other words, the tiboya lo is gilei arayos, but Tesaper imer tamal lefanav aruma, whatever exactly the issur is not more than abizrayu, and the same thing for talking, you know, dirty talking to him. So that's an aside. So the Gemara said, "Penuya." So what was the bit? Why is it so chamor? The Gemara says because in shlote benosis raputzus parayas. And those Jewish women are not cheap, right? You don't do that, right? So then the Gemara asks, I think it's the end of the parak, and it's most fascinating insights Chazal offer, and it is so true, a psychological insight. The Gemara said, well, why didn't he just marry her? Now, I have my own question on this is, who says she wanted to marry this lecher? But let's put that question aside. But the Gemara says, the Gemara's answer is unbelievable. The Gemara says, it wouldn't help. It wouldn't help him if he married her, because then it would be mutter. And it quotes the pasuk from Mishlei, "Mayim genuvim yimtaku, velechem sisarin yinam." The stolen water is sweet, and the bread has to be eaten in secret. Exactly. You know, it's pleasant, right?
Exactly.
I tell my students, Chazal science and medicine is often, it's contemporary science and medicine, and it's often wrong. It's no different. It's whatever you know was found in Greco-Roman society. But Chazal's psychological insights are almost never wrong, and because it's the gathered wisdom of many generations and many centuries, and their psychological insights are so dead on the mark. But that Gemara is just I marvel at that Gemara. Mayim genufim yitaku v'lechem sisarim yin'am. Okay. So anyway, enough batala. Let's come back to our issue. So bottom line is you can have cases of sicknesses. That's not the typical case. I think the common case today would be the issue of a person who might even have said, he could have written as well, take my organs. But if you believe he's halachically alive, there's no Beit Adam L'Chaverish anymore. It's a Beit Adam L'Makom of murder. And that would be the issue. Okay. So now, that was the position of the Rambam. So the Rambam seems to have rejected the position of Karka Ola. He doesn't care about Abaye Shita. Okay, fine. But here is where it gets interested, and here's the cliffhanger. The Bali HaTosfos ask a question. Wasn't Esther married to Mordechai? And why didn't the Gemara raise the issue of Esther was Gilei Arayos? A second question, and I'm going to leave us with this today, is in Gemara and Ksubos. The first Mishnah in Ksubos said that the practice was that Besulos, virgins, were supposed to get married on Monday or Thursday, Leil Revi, okay, on Revi. Besula Nises Berevi V'almana B'chamishi. Why is a Besula supposed to get married on Wednesday? Well, the answer is the assumption is that the wedding would be late Wednesday. It would go into Wednesday night. The consummation of the marriage would take place Wednesday night. And if there was a concern, if the husband claimed the woman wasn't the Besula, and there's a concern that she might have cheated on him between the period of Erisin and Nisun, remember, they separated them. And once you have Erisin, once you have the Kiddushin, the woman is an Ashes Ish. If she cheats on her husband at that point, she's not allowed to remain with him and to be married to him. So they wanted to make sure that if he discovered that she weren't a virgin, it could be many reasons why she wasn't, and not all of which would have created a problem, that he should come to Beis Din the next day, because Beis Din typically only sat on Monday and Thursday. In the context of that Mishnah, Basula Nises Liam Harvi, the Tosefta says that Mimnea Ones, because of Ones, you're allowed to, they could get married a little bit a day earlier. That's what the Gemara says. So what's the Ones? So the Gemara says that the Ones was the hegemon. The hegemon is what was called, I don't know if this was ever true, but it was called the primus noctus, okay? The right of the first night, that's night as in Lila, of the assumption that the nobleman always had the right to sleep with the bride first. I don't know if this is one of those urban legends or true things, but that was known. That's what seems like the hegemon was. The hegemon, in the medieval period, hegemon means bishop, but in the Roman period, there were no bishops, but the hegemon means the ruler or something like that. So the Gemara in that context asks a very odd question. You move up the wedding, so by the time he gets there, it's too late. The bride's already had sex with the groom, and don't bother. So the Gemara says something very strange. Why do you have to undo the takana of the Chachamim, which they felt was very important? Lidrosh lehu de'ones shari. Why don't you preach to the women that in case this happens, ones shari, if you're being forced. Now, shari could mean two things, but it probably means both. It means it's permitted, you don't have to do anything, and you're also not prohibited to your husbands. Now, obviously, an Ashes Kohen is a problem. The Gemara deals with the answer, it gives an explanation, and we might talk about that next week. But there's a very simple question the Balei Tosfos asks. What do you mean, Lidrosh lehu de'ones shari? It's Gilei Arayos, it's Yehari Gal Yavor. You can't just say, you know, tell the Jew, it's okay, don't worry, it's mutter. It's not mutter. She should have to fight the Hegemonoff with everything she has, and if it gets her killed, too bad. Because it's Yehari Gal Yavor. So why does the Gemara say, Vidlidrosh lehu, teach them the ones shari? So God willing, next week, we'll explore the answer to that question.